Applause erupted, and the feeling of relief filled the room.
This has been months in the making, and it's finally here.
UF Health began vaccinating Gainesville-based frontline healthcare workers with the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine today. ER clinical leader Sam Overly was the first person to receive the vaccine.
Having this vaccine offered now gives us a step towards getting back to normal. We trust the science, we trust the research, and it's an honor.
Chief Medical Officer Dr. Parker Gibbs says the vaccine is not mandatory, but is strongly encouraged.
The vaccine protects people from getting severe illness. What we do not know is whether it prevents us from transmitting the virus between each other.
Gibbs says healthcare workers will receive the vaccine in the order of risk of exposure to the virus, and even if you do get the vaccine, personal protective equipment is still needed. Taylor Levesque, WUFT News.
What if you voted in every election in the past decade, with the majority of those rejected?
So basically, you had 10 ballots that didn't count in the election, so your vote didn't.
Oh, really?
Yes. Did you not know?
We sent our stuff out. My wife did.
Edward Palkovic says he didn't have a clue his votes hadn't counted. The Osceola County resident is a registered Republican, and he's voted by mail in 16 elections, with 10 of those not counted.
I don't know. It doesn't make me feel very good.
Already more than 15,000 mail-in ballots have been declared ineligible in Florida, and in 2020, the number of rejected mail-in ballots could affect the outcome of the presidential election. This is particularly concerning to Democrats, as they represent nearly half of the Floridians who voted by mail so far. The Osceola County Supervisor of Elections Office says Palkovic's rejections were from missing signatures. He was also notified by mail each time, but he doesn't recall such notices and says his wife knows more.
Yeah, she mailed the stuff in time, the ballots, we got them and we sent them off and everything seemed to be fine.
His wife, a registered Democrat, says she doesn't know why her husband's ballots didn't count. She's had one rejected ballot in the past 12 years and has made small donations to Democratic candidates. In general, Osceola County is a Democratic stronghold in Florida. It's one of the only 9 counties where Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in 2016. Another was Alachua County. This is where Gainesville resident Monica Thomas had her ballots rejected 5 times between 2008 and 2016. She says she still doesn't know why.
I get a letter in the mail saying that my mail-in ballot wouldn't count, but it doesn't give me no kind of specific reason as to why it wasn't counted, which I never even checked to see, which is bad on my part.
According to the Alachua County Supervisor of Elections Office, letters traditionally state a rejection reason and go out 1 month after Election Day. But Thomas's rejections aren't stopping her from participating this election season.
I ain't gonna stop encouraging others to vote as well. If they don't count mine, at least they count somebody else.
Florida voters can return corrections as late as 5 in the evening Thursday, just 2 days after the presidential election. Malia Leiden, WUFT News. Alex DeLuca also participated in reporting the story.
Nailed it.
Michael Harbison and his wife and daughter have been living in Longville, Louisiana since 2002. A retired marine biologist, his passion became his business, making and selling archery equipment.
I do not advertise, everything is word of mouth.
But his hometown archery business came to an abrupt halt. Category 4 Hurricane Laura slammed into the southwest Louisiana community. The damage? Catastrophic.
It kind of like a nuclear bomb went off.
Splintered trees, destroyed homes, blown out businesses, and scattered roofs marked all that remained after Laura. It was enough to make Michael's house unlivable.
As my daughter says, she's got natural skylights in her room now, is where the limbs came through from the trees that hit.
Needing a new place to live, he was forced to move his family into his business, a small two-room workshop. Then Category 2 Hurricane Delta came through.
Makes it tough. You know, you're trying to get yourself situated from the first one when the second one's coming through.
With his home now beaten and soaked, Michael turned to the one thing he knew would not fail him, his faith. Michael is a devout Catholic, like many others in Southwest Louisiana. His 200-person church, St. Pius X, is the centerpiece of this small 4,000-person community. Seeking some needed relief from the storms at the church, Hurricanes Laura and Delta chipped away at that too.
Total devastation. Total devastation.
Unlike anything Father Andy Derwin had ever experienced.
There's just nothing left. There's just nothing left. It's surreal to have ever walked these halls. Difficult to grapple with.
Debris is scattered everywhere. Records litter the floor, and church innards are strewn about the building. The sanctuary is stripped bare. Gone are the elaborate walls and stained glass windows. Exposed beams are all that remain.
You look at the church, and all you see is rafters, and you think, how on earth are they going to recover from this?
But faith in Southwest Louisiana is enduring. At St. Pius, Mass was held outside until the end of October because the storm damage was so significant.
It's just a building. Your faith is not the building.
Now finally back in the sanctuary, the music continues. The parishioners gather. What were once wooden pews and cushioned kneelers are now fold-up chairs and cold stone floors. While the rebuild is on its way, the church may never be what it once was.
I don't know that we will ever truly recover from the scars that it's left, that Laura and Delta have left. But that doesn't mean that we're any less beautiful. It doesn't mean that we're any weaker for having scars. Scars add character.
And those scars will certainly remain
with your spirit
for Michael and his family.
It'll take a long time. Your faith gets you through a lot, you know. You say a lot of prayers, and that brings you through a lot of what you deal with.
Chris O'Brien, WUFT News.
45 minutes north of Gainesville, Florida. Wilderness hugs this crystal clear water. Ginny Springs is one of 60 natural springs that branch off the 75-mile Santa Fe and Suwannee River system.
I sit over the river a lot on my dock, and I love that. And to me, that's heaven.
But Michael Roth's slice of heaven is being threatened.
The springs, which everybody's seen pictures of the springs at their peak 20 years ago, you can see before where it's clear, blue, beautiful. And now, at its best, it's a kind of an aquamarine hazy view.
Water at Ginny Springs has been bottled and sold for the last 20 years. The Seven Springs bottling plant captured about 300,000 gallons of Ginny Springs water a day for the last 4 years, well under the 1.152 million gallons its permit allows. But the plant was sold a year ago, and its new owner, Nestle, is ready to pump the maximum.
They insist it's not an increase in capacity, it's always been that capacity. Well, the fact is it's akin to an increase in capacity because nobody's used more than a quarter. They're going to use it all.
But that plan is on hold. Nestle's permit expired in June. While the company waits to see if it can get a renewal by the Suwannee River Water Management District, the community has mobilized. Allison Guy is an organizer with global nonprofit Some of Us. She says she's worked on campaigns against Nestle before.
They are taking community water, water that the community has a right to, water that the community has a right to manage for themselves and for their future generations.
With the final say in the hands of its six-member governing board, residents have poured out in numbers to voice their opposition. A December water management district meeting turned into a rallying cry when dozens of people waited to address the board one by one.
When you've got a massive, giant, corporate, huge behemoth coming into town to suck us dry.
2 hours of public comment, all echoing the same sentiment.
No to someone taking our water.
Spokeswoman for the Water Management District, Caitlin Potter, says the district's team of environmental experts is looking at all potential impacts and risks before the six-member board votes on Nestle's permit renewal.
They are following the statutes and they are giving every permit applicant the same opportunity to make their case of whether they should or shouldn't have the water that they're requesting.
One of the biggest concerns, the river's already low water level, and the worry Nestle's increased pumping could cause permanent damage to Ginny Springs.
We're continuing to degrade it, and we're continuing to allow permits to go through without realizing what we are doing to our springs.
The company released a statement addressing those concerns, stating, "We have a 25-year record of working on aquifer protection and recharge projects, and it would make no sense to invest millions of dollars just to deplete the natural resources on which our business relies." Yet, despite reassurances, Michael Roth still worries whether Nestle will be taking too much.
You have a dying patient on the table here. The Santa Fe River is not even running at minimum flows. If you take a spoonful of water out of a glass of water, it's still less water. And if you're dying of thirst, then it's a lot of water.
Valerie Lyons, WUFT News.
Under the Highway 47 bridge in Fort White flows the Santa Fe River, a river that's home to recreational activities and family fun. But with all those people come a lot of garbage. And it affects more than the spot where it's tossed.
So the Santa Fe River is part of a larger river system.
That's environmentalist Nicole Linas, who says Florida's waterways connect.
It all flows in together and joins and actually flows out into the Gulf of Mexico.
So that's where diver James Merritt and his partner Joe DeLeonardo come in to scrub the river floor.
We're going to go ahead and drift on down the Santa Fe River and pick up any type of trash or anything else that we can find in the river.
They zip up their gear and head out.
All right, you ready, Joe?
While James and Joe dive, Sarah Gottman keeps an eye at the surface.
I wait for them to bring all the trash up, and I hold on to it in the kayak.
Making trip after trip to drop off what they found. Mostly soda cans, bottles, and of course, plastic.
It's not just hurting the wildlife. It's not just hurting our springs and our waterways. It's hurting the community as a whole.
Spending an hour under the water and only venturing out 50 yards, they managed to collect about 40 pounds of garbage. But Nicole Lina says to get a real feel for how bad the garbage problem is, multiply that number by 100.
In May, we pulled out 4,000 pounds from the Santa Fe River.
So next time you're out on the river, listen to James and Joe.
Just pick it up. Out of sight, out of mind, don't work. We'll find it. So just pick it up.
Ed Kellerman's home seems like any other on the block. Tucked in a sleepy neighborhood in Northwest Gainesville, it's like a suburban dream. Pulling up, you'd never expect what's inside.
Hey, welcome to the National Museum for Political Memorabilia. This is the first stop.
The living room. Sitting prominently on the main wall, Kellerman's centerpiece of John Kerry buttons.
Every collector has a centerpiece. It's one of only 350 sets of pins put out. It's a 9-inch plate plus all the 50 states and the four possessions of the United States.
And there's a lot more where that came from. Just up the stairs, Kellerman keeps over 4,000 political mementos.
Who else would have a roll of 500 Bush Cheney 04 stickers?
500 Bush Cheney 04 stickers, along with impeach mints, Wilkie bells, and even a pill bottle with prescription for change written on it. Somewhere, he says, is a Biden fly swatter.
My favorite pin is right over there, aging hippies for Obama.
But where do collectors like Kellerman get all this stuff?
This is called the shell.
Well, he makes some of his own with a button press.
One. And a crimping.
But the other main source of memorabilia, conventions.
$25, $25 I have.
Just before COVID-19 rocked the U.S., the Broward Palm Beach chapter of the American Political Items Collectors held its annual show. Collectors from all over crowded into a high school gym, including 20-year-old Justin McCulloch, a college history major home for spring break.
My grandfather's been a collector, and then my favorite high school teacher was a collector. So between the pair of them, going to school and then going home, I saw collectors for 24 hours in the day, it seems like.
I caught up with McCulloch after he won a bag of Lyndon B. Johnson memorabilia for just $10. LBJ is his favorite president.
There was some really cool LBJ stuff I didn't have. So it was probably the best thing I bought all day. Between price and what I got, that way was just great.
Also at the show was 52-year collecting veteran Ken Hosner. He says buttons and other memorabilia can help influence elections.
When people see the button, they know somebody's for them. You know, over the course of the years, I've had many, many people. During the campaign, I tend to wear buttons supporting the person I support. And, hey, where'd you get that? Well, you want one?
University of Florida political science professor Michael Martinez agrees with Hosner. He says political mementos can help supporters connect, even in today's digitally driven society.
Even Donald Trump's caps, right? Make America great again, right? Presumably, those are going to be part of that memorabilia for generations in the future, and people will be able to relate to that, or at least relate that hat to Trump's campaign.
But even if the general public doesn't remember, collectors like Ed Kellerman definitely will. He loves to share his knowledge, and he'll even share his house with you for a night or two.
You've heard of the Lincoln Suite that you can rent for a couple of $1,000 a night in the White House? Here, we'll let you stay here for $5 or $10 a night with the Obama throw blanket.
And after a roller coaster of an election cycle, one thing's for sure. Kellerman will be talking about this one for years to come. Anthony Montalto, WUFT News.
The year is 1990, and a killer is on the loose in Gainesville, Florida. A man who would murder five, all students. Without smartphones, the only information came through newspapers, TV, and radio. Over the span of 4 days, panic gripped the city and University of Florida. This is 4 days, five murders, and I'm Camille Respis. The man responsible for the nightmare is often remembered. And the victims' names?
Krista Lee Hoyt, Sonia Jane Larson, Tracy Inez Paulus, Christina Patricia Powell, and Manuel Ricardo Taboada
are painted on a memorial. Many pass by daily without knowing why it's there. Throughout this podcast, we will rarely mention the name Danny Rawling. But no matter what we do, his presence hangs like a specter over this project. In the coming episodes, we explore the trauma a moment in time can have on people and places, and how long a tragedy like this stays in a place like Gainesville.
She was driving off to head to Gainesville, packed up her little car, which held her whole life in it, and the flow came about me that I thought, I said, Trace, I have this feeling that you're going to go to Gainesville and I'm not going to see you again.
This is what Lori Leahy told her sister, Tracy Paulus, during a phone call in early August of 1990. Leahy was in Atlanta, Georgia, and called Paulus as her sister was preparing to leave her parents' house in Miami. She says she couldn't help blurting out her thoughts, and it made Paulus uneasy.
And she's like, what? Why do you say stuff like this to me? You're freaking me out. And I go, I don't know. And then she goes, stop it. I'm going to be fine. And we blew it off. And off she went.
But Leahy couldn't have known her intuition would prove correct. Tracy Paulus and Manny Taboada's dead bodies were found at Gatorwood Apartments on August 28, 1990. Taboada, a 23-year-old UF student with a lively spirit, was known as an upstanding guy. The South Florida native played football in high school and planned on getting a degree in architecture. Paulus was also a 23-year-old UF student and dreamed of being a lawyer. She was her high school's homecoming queen and salutatorian, and Paulus and Taboada were friends, both in high school and at UF. Paulus's loss was a blow to her sister Lori Leahy, as she jumped on a flight with her husband from Atlanta to Miami after finding out Tracy had been murdered.
I was wishing the plane would crash because I didn't want to continue living. She was my life.